Justice Namias, thank you very much for having us in your chambers here.
Well, thanks. It's been a difficult weekend in thinking about Justice Scalia, but in many ways it's also kind of enjoyable to see all these remembrances of him from different perspectives.
What was it like to clerk for someone who, at least to the general public, appeared to be as exacting and as demanding as he appeared to be?
Well, it's an extraordinary experience to clerk at the U.S. Supreme Court generally, whoever you're working for. As I used to say, you walk into the building every day and are kind of impressed by the majesty of things. And he was a wonderful person to clerk for. He was demanding, but not in a kind of yelling at you or telling you you weren't doing well way. Basically, everyone tried to live up to what he was doing. He was such a perfectionist and worked extremely hard that all of his clerks were kind of in awe of what he did and did our best to even approximate what he was doing.
Was there anything that you took from him that you now feel like you want to exemplify, if you will, on the bench where you sit now?
Probably the two things that I am most focused on that I learned from him and also from other judges I saw are his incredible devotion to trying to figure out what the law says based on the written word and precedent, and to exclude every consideration of politics or personal belief. I think that's something all judges struggle with, whether they do it consciously or unconsciously. But I know he was very dedicated to trying to do that. People argue about how successful he always was, but having worked with him side by side for a year, I think he was as dedicated as any judge was to that. And I have tried to do the same, not only as a judge, but when I was a prosecutor as well. The other thing I try very hard to do is to be very careful about everything. And you know, one of the things he would do before an opinion went out, he would have his law clerk who worked on the opinion with him get every single case that was cited, and we used to do it in the books back then, and we called it booking it. And you would put every case he cited, you would bring the book in on a cart, and you would go through every single case to make sure that it was quoted accurately. When we said it held something instead of just kind of saying something in dicta, that was accurate. And that's the sort of thing that most judges have, maybe a law clerk, sometimes even a secretary do. But he was so concerned about trying to be very careful in his writing that he would do that. And it extended to his memos and everything else. I mean, he worried about typos, and that's something I continue to worry about. And I think that's very important in judges trying to get things right.
You've heard, I'm sure, people say, well, he was one of the justices, some on both sides over the years, who, at least in the view of those who were watching, let his personal convictions on social issues, for instance, enter into his decisions. How would you respond to that, especially when people cite the Obamacare decision, for instance? He wrote a vigorous dissent in that, or in Citizens United.
Well, again, I think he tried as hard as he can, as anyone can, to try to separate those two things. Now, he has a philosophy of interpretation, which he was a champion of, and frankly went from being considered kind of an outcast view to a very clear mainstream view, and one that, frankly, I think most Americans, when you kind of describe views, often agree with. So sometimes some of the social issues that he would write in dissent on, they reflect a view that historically those were things that the Constitution didn't cover. The big difference is I think he was always very, very clear that he didn't believe, for example, that abortion could be constitutionally prohibited. He thought that it was simply an issue the Constitution didn't address and therefore left to the democratic branches of government and the people to decide. You can point to a variety of opinions, and he did, where his personal beliefs were squarely opposed to what he decided. One great example is anyone who spent any time with Justice Scalia would know he had no love of criminal defendants and people who violated the law, but he revolutionized a couple areas that are extremely favorable to criminal defendants involving the Confrontation Clause and sentencing, because he believed that's what the Constitution's original meaning was.
The Confrontation Clause meaning the accused has a right to confront the accuser.
Right. And he said, it says you have a right to confront, and therefore you have a right to confront. Courts that looked more at kind of balancing things had said for a generation before that, that it should be up to the court to decide, well, you didn't get to see your accuser, but we think the information was reliable. And he said, no, you get to actually see your accuser in court. So there are a variety of areas like that. Another area is, I don't think Justice Scalia personally loved plaintiff's lawyers who might get an enormous punitive damages verdict on relatively thin evidence. But his view, which was a dissenting view and still is, was Constitution doesn't say that judges get to tell juries they awarded too much damages. So that was a view that would have been very favorable to tort lawyers, but the majority of the court read into the Due Process Clause some ability of judges to control that. So there are all kinds of areas where his view of the law, which was I'm just going to read the law and apply it, squarely contradicted what he would have done had he been an elected legislator.
But the Constitution is also worded, particularly the Bill of Rights, in such general terms that one can say they are interpreting it strictly. Let's say the Equal Protection Clause and gay marriage, where Justice Scalia was vigorously saying, no, it does not apply. I mean, does the fact that somebody disagrees with him mean that they are straying from a strict interpretation of the Constitution?
Well, I think you can read his opinions in those cases and see who has the better of that debate. His view, again, was not, for example, he said that the Constitution is worded broadly and therefore should be given an expansive interpretation. One of his great frustrations was people who would attribute to him or other conservative judges the idea of strict construction, which is more of a term of art than reality. He would say it shouldn't be strict or liberal. It should be a fair interpretation, but an interpretation based on what the words say and what they were understood to the people who enacted those words.
That's where I was going, because he said it should be the way what it meant to the people who put it together, and yet we all know there are things they could not have ever anticipated.
Right, and his view on that is when they didn't anticipate things, that was left to the democratic process. And so, for example, on gay marriage, I mean, I think his opinions say it's up to the people in the states or Congress, and fine if people could be convinced that that was the right thing to do. But if you look at the status of gay marriage in 1868, when the 14th Amendment was passed, there would be no question that the people who put that amendment into the Constitution would not have thought that that was the outcome. Other people disagree with that interpretation, but the effect of his interpretive view is that more issues were left to democracy and fewer issues are decided by nine people who happen to be lawyers given a robe and told that they're allowed to decide constitutional issues. And I think that was his greatest frustration, was the view that judges take on more and more responsibility for deciding everything in society. Some people like that. Some people don't like that. I know where he came down on that issue.
Knowing him as you did, it was probably no surprise to you that he and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, for instance, who probably was opposite him on many of the major decisions of the court, were great friends.
All right. One of the things about Justice Scalia, putting aside the way he was portrayed often in the media and in other areas, almost anyone who interacted with him, he was hard not to like. I mean, he was incredibly witty, engaging, well-versed on everything from hunting to opera, and got along well with people and had many friends who legally violently disagreed with him, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg is the best example of that.
He certainly liked them. Did he respect their legal opinions, though?
Oh, I think he respected their legal opinions greatly.
Because you read his dissents and you think, oh, he thinks they're a bunch of idiots.
His dissents, particularly in the later years, tended to be pretty acerbic. But I think part of that was his frustration at not always having his view of what's good for the country and the Constitution prevail. But the people on the other side of those, Ruth Ginsburg has said, you know, the dissents help sharpen her opinions. And I know that's true as a judge. The great danger in writing opinions for a court is you tend to say things that haven't been pushed to make sure that you're saying them very precisely if there's no one on the other side saying you're getting it wrong. When someone says you're getting it wrong, you look twice at everything you say. And so I think his dissents had that value, and he respected the people who wrote dissents on the other side of his majority opinions.
He was such a vigorous questioner from the bench, too. Do you take any of that into the way you address attorneys who are arguing before the state Supreme Court?
I get asked that a lot with the assumption that he was my role model, because I do ask of questions.
Yes.
But frankly, I work for a judge on the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia who also was an aggressive questioner, as were a lot of other judges on that court and in the 11th Circuit Federal Court of Appeals, for example. So he certainly brought a more aggressive style, as I understand it, to the Supreme Court. By the time I got there to clerk for him, there were a number of other people asking a lot of questions. My own view is, and I think his view was, if you have questions, you should let the advocates know about them and give them the chance to answer them. You're going to have the same questions and try to come up with answers on your own, no matter whether you ask them or not. And it's a good thing to be asked questions. Now, there are arguments that the U.S. Supreme Court has gotten full of so many questions that it's hard for the advocates to do much of anything. Our court is not at that point, but I think the worst thing in an oral argument is not to be getting any questions, because it indicates the judges have their minds made up.
You talked about his portrayal in the media, but media or not, was there something about him, as big a personality as he was, that you knew that maybe folks did not know, that you would like to tell people about him?
You never know with people. You only see through their public image what they're really like. And one of the things that I know for his law clerks, which included not me, but over 100 other young lawyers who he gave this great opportunity to both work for him and then a credential that is enormously important for your legal career, is how caring he was for what he called his clerkerati and his interest in their careers and their success. He was very loyal. We asked him to come to Georgia a couple times to speak at meetings and symposia, and you know, he was very responsive to that. And so for all the people who came to him in that setting, I think we all lost a very loyal mentor and a great friend. And that's something you never know from the outside if people have this big persona and are really jerks. He was not a jerk to the people around him. They cared for him. And the other thing that, you know, people knew that he was a Catholic, but he was truly a devoted man of his faith. He went to Mass virtually every day. When we were hunting in South Georgia, it can be kind of hard to find a Catholic church, but we made sure we found one on Sunday morning so he could go to Mass. And that was a big part of his life, his devotion to God. And one thing I feel comfortable with what happened is I don't think he had any fear of death. I think he felt he had lived a life devoted to his faith, and that probably gave him a lot of comfort as he got older.
Had you spoken with him recently?
I hadn't spoken for a few months, but I last spoke to him about a potential law clerk who we ended up hiring. And one of the tragedies in this is also there were a group of young people who were going to have this tremendous opportunity and tremendous credential and may never get it now because of his passing. The other ironic thing is he would have an annual meeting or an annual reunion of his law clerks every year at the court in May, and just Saturday morning the email went out to give us a date and invite everyone to come. And so it's obviously a shock to everyone that in the morning you get an email that kind of reminds you of this network of people connected at Justice Scalia, and then in the afternoon this news came along.
Would you say he is your biggest role model in the law, or was he one of several big ones?
I've been fortunate to have some great role models, and he was certainly one. But I clerked for another judge on the appellate court who was a great role model, and I've had the opportunity to work with other great lawyers and judges. The thing I don't think I'll ever be able to come close to, but would love and strive to, is to be able to write not good legal writing, but good writing. And I think that's one reason he was so influential, not just in the legal community, but in the popular community, is because his writing was entertaining and direct in the way that very few lawyers and judges are able to do. And that's something I strive to do, to find a phrase or two that reads like something he would have written.
Now the search begins for a new justice, and you can answer this as extensively or not as you like. As you read the Constitution, do you think the Senate should move forward should President Obama come up with a name and submit it to the Senate?
Well, you know, all of that is a political process, and I'm not comfortable commenting much on it other than to say it is an intensely political process. And given what's happened in Washington over the last many years, and particularly in the area of federal judges, it's hard to be very optimistic that things will move smoothly or in a way that is probably good for the overall reputation of the court.
Is it good for the court, though, assuming there's a delay, to be with just eight justices given some of the major cases it now has before it?
I'm sure the court would like to have a full complement to divide the workload to be able to decide things. But again, I think they are all experienced enough to realize that this is going to be a political process, as all confirmations have been for 30 years now. People forget that Justice Scalia was unanimously confirmed by the Senate. His was the last confirmation before Robert Bork's process, which kind of changed the way those things were handled. And, you know, for good or bad, that's, I think, what the country's going to face over the upcoming period.
How much does that concern you, though, with justices being labeled liberal or conservative as if they were running for a legislative office?
Well, I know they, and I know I and my colleagues don't like when the first line of a media story is, you know, this judge, a Republican or Democratic appointee. There certainly is a reality that judges' judicial philosophies may be more aligned, more or less aligned with the people who appointed them. But, you know, an automatic labeling of this person was appointed by a Republican or Democratic president. I know that what Chief Justice Roberts recently complained about that in something I saw. So every justice is focused on trying to apply the law to the facts. People have different philosophies about how to do that, but they are not political philosophies. They are different judicial philosophies. You rarely will get a judge who says, I want this case to come out this way because it helps a Democrat or a Republican Congress or anything. But that may well be the way that their philosophies applied to the law and a set of facts would lead. Those are two different things.
Certainly folks look at Bush v. Gore and argue right. that there might have been a political intent at some point along the way. Did Justice Scalia ever talk about that to you?
I never talked to him about cases that he had decided, except when I was working for him. And one of the things he insists with his clerks is that you wouldn't share confidences until both of us die. So unfortunately, part of that has happened now. But, you know, again, based on my experience with him, he decided that case based on his view of the law and the facts, and not on the result. I never knew him to focus on the result of a case.
And he never talked to you about the popular debate that went on where many people felt that the court was divided along those partisan lines?
He never talked to me about it. I know I read at some point in his typical acerbic way. When somebody complained about it, I think a law school symposium or something, he told everybody that they just needed to get over it. But that was his response after many years of getting questions about it. But I never talked to him about it.
As we mentioned, the nomination process could get quite political. There certainly has been speculation that should a Republican take the White House and Republicans keep control of the Senate and the nomination is delayed, several conditions there, that your name might come up. Is this something that you have considered or would be interested in?
I hear that kind of talk every once in a while, and it's very flattering, but it is not something I think is either very realistic or that I have any focus on. I'm very fortunate to have the position I have, and I'm on the highest court in the state I grew up in and live in, and am happy doing this.
You would
and
be.
Hopefully I'll have the opportunity to do this. I have another election this year, and so it's up to the people of Georgia whether I even get to do this job.
You wouldn't be human, though, especially since this is the seat held by the person for whom you clerked, if you didn't think about it a little.
That court has many things that are good about it, and many things that I think are very difficult. And so it is not, as some people might say, just an unthinking view that being on the Supreme Court of the United States is the greatest job around. I think the people who get
on— Justice Scalia seemed to think so.
I think the people who get on that court, having gone through the process, may enjoy it, but it is a very difficult process now for some of the reasons we said, to go through the process, not just for that court, but for any federal court. And once you're there, it's a pretty good job, at least in terms of the way you're treated, and they don't decide that many cases a year compared to the Georgia Supreme Court, so the workload is not quite as overwhelming.
But if a president came to you and offered it, you wouldn't say no.
It's hard to say no to anything a president offers you, but I don't expect that'll happen, and it's certainly not something that I have any focus on at all.
You knew him. People have called him one of the most consequential justices of the last 100 years. Would you think he was?
I don't think there's any doubt that he is a true giant in the law. And Justice Scalia's life is really an example, and there aren't that many in that I can think of these days, of ideas and the written word influencing a huge area of discussion and debate that's important to the country. So much of the world now is focused on visual images or speeches. What judges fundamentally do is write opinions and occasionally write law review articles and things like that. And that's what Justice Scalia focused on. And he was so good and so persuasive at doing it that whole areas of legal thought have changed in a generation, and he's been at the forefront of that. And it's hard to point to a lot of other areas where a single individual largely expressing their views in writing has been able to have that kind of influence. Certainly can point to more historic figures like Chief Justice John Marshall and a few others, but in terms of actual influence on the way people think about not just constitutional law, but the interpretation of legal texts. If you read opinions from the Supreme Court now compared to opinions from 1984, the way all the justices approach issues is very different. You will see very little discussion of legislative history in the form of like what one senator happened to say on the floor of the Senate or in a committee report. And when it is said, it's said defensively, kind of, we're also looking at this, but we know we should barely be looking at it. You see debates over originalism. The Heller opinion about the meaning of the Second Amendment, Justice Scalia's side of that for the majority was not surprising. He did a very detailed historical analysis. But Justice Stevens' side of the dissent, what's telling is it was predominantly a historical discussion. It was engaged on Justice Scalia's terms in a way that would have been unthinkable when Justice Stevens joined the court. So the discourse changed, and it changed largely because of Justice Scalia.
David Namias, Associate Justice of the Georgia Supreme Court, thank you so much for being with us.
No, thank you, and appreciate your remembrance of Justice Scalia.